Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's the News Roundup, where we talk to area journalists about the stories making regional news this week. In recent months, public information about the construction of Vineyard Wind has been hard to come by. The company has refused to answer many questions from the media, including basic questions about the number of turbines that are spinning and sending power to the grid. Last week, CAI and the Martha's Vineyard Times teamed up to visit the wind farm by boat to look for visual evidence of what's happening. And that same day as the trip, one of the parent companies of Vineyard Wind issued an investor report saying 17 turbines are operational. But it would be hard to know what from what our reporters saw in the field. Jeanette Barnes of CAI and Haley Duffy of the Martha's Vineyard Times are here to talk about the story. Good morning, Jeanette. Good morning, Haley.
Hi, Mindy.
Hi, Mindy.
All right. So first, give us a sense of what it's been like trying to get information about Vineyard Wind in the last 6 months or so. Jeanette.
Sure. Well, looking at other news outlets, as you said, it's been clear that for a while, getting information from Vineyard Wind that's really meaningful in any way has been difficult. And I think that's why back in May, that story that the State House News Service had where they got the Healey administration to reveal how many turbines they had been told were operating at Vineyard Wind. I think that's why that happened. And they said just four at that time. Vineyard Wind wasn't saying that themselves. So, you know, it's been difficult, at least since January. For me personally, when I look back at the emails, I think I haven't gotten an on-the-record response to questions that I individually asked them since the day after the inauguration, interestingly. Mm-hmm. And that was also the day after the offshore wind executive order was issued, halting permitting. Vineyard Wind did now, in response to Nantucket's press conference the other day, accusing them of not communicating, they did then issue a statement, but that was kind of a blanket statement sent to all media. And it was very different just a couple years ago in 2023, 2022, back when Klaus Müller was the CEO. I talked to him pretty regularly. So we have had some, as I said, some turning points since then, the blade break, the new presidency, and so on.
Yeah. Same for you, Haley, right?
Yeah. Jeanette's been in this a little longer than I have, but pretty much the same sort of sentiment from them. And I think what I've heard is that Vineyard Wind doesn't necessarily want to comment on anything, good or bad, because drawing ire either from the presidential administration or, you know, in either way, good or bad, that might reflect badly on the industry.
Trying to stay under the radar, yeah. All right, so CAI and the Martha's Vineyard Times decided to send you both out by boat to Vineyard Wind. This is 15 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. Tell us about the trip and what you saw.
Sure, yep. It was last Wednesday, the 23rd. It was a nice day, not too rough on the water, but from my understanding, it was definitely not so calm that it would have prevented turbines from running. And as the wind farm started to come into view, it seemed to us like only one turbine was spinning. Naturally, as you get closer, you get a better view. But we, you know, we actually saw as we got closer, some of them start up. So we're watching a turbine. It's still, and then it powers up. Actually, the one that was the closest to us is one of the ones that powered up. So We kept driving around, looking around. We were at one point we were seeing five, then six. My understanding, and Haley, you can chime in, but my understanding is we never saw more than nine that were running at any one time. We saw the service platform, some other things, and we saw an installation vessel that was stationary next to a turbine. It had a clamp on a blade, but there were no workers that we could see on that installation vessel.
Yeah, Haley.
Yeah. I mean, as both Jeanette and I kind of figured out, you can't really see all the turbines all at the same time when you're on the water. But you know, we were looking around for the 2 hours that we were out there trying to count how many we saw actually spinning. And I think in that time frame, we saw 5 to 9. And it was just interesting that that report came out the same day. Just pure coincidence. And they said that 17 were operational and sending power to the grid.
Yeah. And so as was one of the parent companies happened to give a quarterly report. Were you able to get information about the difference between that and what you were seeing?
Well, I mean, in line with all that media silence that we were talking about before, Vineyard Wind refused to comment to us on that discrepancy. I had first asked them about it on Monday. They asked for more time, which initially sounded promising. And then Tuesday, the Nantucket press conference happened. Admittedly, they did have a lot going on. But then in the end, they came back and said, no, they were not going to make any comment about that discrepancy. 17 turbines in the report versus a maximum of 9 that we saw running. We should say that wind turbines don't always run 24 hours a day. They do get shut off for maintenance. They also go through an extensive testing period when they're brand new that involves on and off periods. But even knowing that, it seems like what we saw may not fit with the idea of those 7 turbines sending power to the grid. Again, you know, with Vineyard Wind not providing any explanation, it leaves a lot of room for wondering.
Yeah. Haley, what about getting information from the New England grid operator?
Yeah, so I talked to them because I thought it would be interesting to see if you could tell how many megawatts are sent from a single generator, so just the Vineyard Wind offshore wind farm. However, they have an information policy where they cannot speak to the generation of a single energy source, which made things kind of difficult. You are able to look at their dashboard, and they have offshore and onshore wind grouped together for the entire grid and how many megawatts are being used by the grid at a certain point in time. However, it's updated very frequently. So, you know, I checked it a bunch of times, and at different times, there 112 megawatts were being used by onshore and offshore wind. 570 was a different point the day prior. But for Vineyard Wind, if they have 17 turbines sending power to the grid and each turbine has the capacity of 13 megawatts, total, their capacity is 221. So it is kind of difficult to quantify how much a single generator source is sending to the grid. And I think it would be something interesting to find out.
Yeah. And did it tell you why they couldn't tell you that information, Jeanette? Why that policy?
Right. Well, again, Haley reached out to them, and their spokesperson said that if they revealed how much an individual facility is generating, that other companies could use that information to predict the actions of their competitors mm-hmm. and then kind of set their own bids in a way that would be manipulating the market price.
Yeah, so it's not like they don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So what's next for Vineyard Wind?
Well, the investor report said last week that Vineyard Wind anticipates being at their official full commercial operation by the end of this year. That's a date they've given before. So they have a ways to go from 17 to full operation. Although someone told me once that there's like commercial operation does not necessarily mean 100% absolutely of the turbines. It's a certain certain proportion of it for functional commercial operation.
Right. And Haley, so for you, the trip gave you a lot more questions than answers, right?
Yeah. Yes. It was my first time out there. I know Jeanette's been a couple times, but it was very surreal to see the massiveness of these turbines and the substation and the installation vessel. It's nothing like I've ever seen before, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, I definitely have more questions, which I think is great as a journalist and some on offshore wind. But definitely have a lot more work to do.
Right. Haley Duffy from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Haley, thanks so much. Appreciate that.
Thank
you. Jeanette, before you go, I want to ask you about another story you reported this week. This is about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. The company that owns Pilgrim gave a presentation this week to answer some questions that the state nuclear panel had been asking for a long time. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so members of the panel and from the public have been questioning Holtec, the owner of Pilgrim, for a long time about what exactly are they doing to treat the water? Because people throw around the word filtering as if filtering is going to do it, which it's not with a radiological material. And they've said they treat the water. So what exactly is that? So they made a presentation this time, David Noyes, who represents Holtec on the on the state nuclear panel, said they do use filters. They also use charcoal and they use ion exchange resin. So that has positively and negatively charged ions, and it can remove some of the radiological elements from the water. Not all of them, we should note, and not absolutely 100%, but it does make a big difference. And he was describing that process. There's 10 cubic feet of charcoal, 20 cubic feet of this resin and so forth. And they can change the mix of those things in order to get the best numbers they can.
So what's the latest with the physical plan in terms of demolition and things like that?
A number of buildings have been demolished in the last year or so. There were no major ones demolished in this update. But what they have done is they have drained that radioactive water from two areas of the plant, the reactor cavity and something called the dryer separator pit. And they're still in the plant, but they've drained them into another area that's more enclosed. That's called the torus. And they've said in the past that that should reduce the amount of evaporation happening because that's a more enclosed space. So that evaporation is something that people in the community have been really concerned about because as Holtec moves forward with this appeal to the state told them they couldn't just release the water into Cape Cod Bay. Holtec is appealing. But in the meantime, it's gradually becoming less and less water because that is evaporating into the outdoor air.
Right. And there's been a number of people in the community that continue to have serious objections to what Holtec is doing, right?
Yes, definitely. People in the community, first of all, are supporting the state in its denial of Holtec's permit to release that water into the bay. They're also talking. They also spoke at the meeting this week about security concerns for the nuclear material, the spent fuel that's stored on that site in Plymouth. So this is completely separate from the water issue that we report on so much. But it's nuclear waste, essentially, the spent fuel is stored in these steel-reinforced concrete drums. They're called casks, but they are essentially stored outside. They're visible from the street. And Diane Turco from Harwich, who's one of the activists who's involved in this, her group is called Cape Downwinders. She said this week at the meeting that their group has been asking for access to that area to be reviewed, to be improved, in other words, to be made more secure so that it's not vulnerable to potential terrorism and things like that.
Mm. All right, CAI's Jeanette Barnes. As always, thank you so much, Jeanette.
Thanks, Mindy.
Vineyard Wind also making headlines on Nantucket this week. Jason Graziade from the Nantucket Courant has details on that story. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
So tell us what happened this week.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, Nantucket Select Board called a press conference, which for the Select Board, that's a very rare thing to do. I can probably count on one hand the number of times the Select Board has called a press conference over the last 20 years on Nantucket. And it was basically to call Vineyard Wind on the carpet, saying they've failed to live up to the agreements that it has with the town. The town of Nantucket signed a good neighbor, what is called the good neighbor agreement with Vineyard Wind back in 2020, which in exchange for the town's support of the project, Vineyard Wind paid the town $16 million and agreed to some concessions, which included the installation of what is called an ADLS, the aircraft detection lighting system, which is going to be installed on all new offshore wind farms, but this was sort of novel at the time. And basically, it shuts down the lights at the top of the towers if a plane is detected in the area. That's the only time. They only turn on when a plane comes in the area. Otherwise, they're off. Mm-hmm. If you look offshore right now, you'll see the lights at night blinking. It looks like a huge airport at sea. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the things that the town brought up, saying that Vineyard Wind has failed to live up to its agreement to install this system. They brought up a number of other points in terms of the communication from Vineyard Wind, the delay in notifying the town first of the blade failure back in July of 2024 over 48 hours until debris started washing up on shore. Town officials had no idea. Then there was another incident with that same turbine in February of 2025 when it was struck by lightning. And again, the town was upset about the lack of timeliness on the communication from Vineyard Wind about the incident.
Yeah. So also, you mentioned that good neighbor agreement. That's kind of been hotly debated as well, right?
It has. It's very controversial here on Nantucket. And they last year, a group called Keep Nantucket Wild submitted a petition to the select board that was signed by thousands of residents, hundreds of businesses, demanding that the select board withdraw from the good neighbor agreement. And this was obviously following the blade failure that, closed the beach in the middle of the summer, had debris washing up. So the board has talked about this quite a bit, saying that they feel that it gives them leverage to stay in the agreement and that there would be no benefits to the town for pulling out of it at this point. The Mariah Mitchell Association, which is a nonprofit on the island and was also a party to the Good Neighbor Agreement, did in fact withdraw and pull out of the agreement last October, stating some of the same things that the selectmen said on Tuesday at the press conference, that Vineyard Wind had simply failed to live up to what it had set out, and focusing really on the lighting system as well.
Right. Now, as you mentioned, this list of demands, 15 demands, right, with a 2-week deadline. But I think what they're thinking is that 2 weeks is not an unreasonable amount of time, because these demands have been presented before. This isn't anything
exactly
new to them. Is that right?
And that's what the select board said, is that Vineyard Wind has been aware of all of these demands from the town for many months, and that they have been communicated to Vineyard Wind privately, going back months now. But that how the select board described it, they said the Vineyard Wind has basically gone into hiding, is the words they used, since President Trump came into office and, set in motion policies that are against offshore wind, and that the select board feel that the Vineyard Wind had basically gone into hiding to avoid scrutiny from the Trump administration. A select board member, Brooke Moore, told us up until, the press conference, they had not heard anything from Vineyard Wind since February.
And so there was a statement, right, from Vineyard Wind. Is that going to suffice, or what's the next steps?
Yeah, shortly after the press conference, probably, 3 or 4 hours after, Vineyard Wind made its first public statement, in months, acknowledged the town's press conference. It wasn't a sort of response to each of the demands, but saying that they are going to sort of resume normal communications. But even in that statement, you had Vineyard Wind saying that they were party to the settlement with GE Vernova, the $10.5 million settlement that the town signed with the turbine blade manufacturer earlier this month. But at the time, the town specifically said, we did not allow Vineyard Wind to be a signatory because they have not lived up to their agreement with us. So they're sort of taking credit for being part of this agreement, even though the town specifically said they were not a signatory, although it does waive them from any liability. They were released from any liability as part of that settlement.
Yeah. So what if there is no response to these demands? What recourse does the town have?
Yeah, I mean, this is the point that we were trying to drill down on, and the town and its attorney, Cultural Heritage Partners, were, somewhat evasive on. What happens if, these list of demands are not met? They've sort of hinting at potential legal action to say, we have a contract with Vineyard Wind, and potentially that could, involve litigation down the road in 2 weeks if the response from Vineyard Wind is not deemed adequate. Mm-hmm. Again, many people said, the appropriate response would be to pull out or withdraw from the agreement. But so far, the town has been unwilling to do that, and saying that, this gives them leverage, and that it is a legal, binding contract on Vineyard Wind. So
yeah,
we're going to see what happens here in 2 weeks.
Another story is some may not realize that Nantucket has a chain store ban for the downtown area. And you have a story about that ban being enforced on a store called Roll the Rabbit.
Yeah, this is a sort of pajama boutique store called Roller Rabbit, which opened a store on Center Street earlier this year. We, heard some rumblings and actually obtained the enforcement order that the town gave to Roller Rabbit, saying they must immediately cease all business activity because their store violates the town's chain store ban. This is a bylaw that was passed all the way back in 2006, and it prohibits chain stores from operating in the sort of core downtown historic district. And it sets some definitions for what a chain store is. Ten or more locations, similar logos and, uniforms or interior decor in all of their stores. And this was really back in 2006. It was a response to Ralph Lauren buying a storefront on Main Street, coming into downtown, downtown Nantucket. And it was a sort of a response to that big national brand coming in. So it really we're not aware of any other times that this has been enforced, and they're on Nantucket. Roller Rabbit does have 12 stores, so that's above the sort of threshold of 10 set in there. What we also noticed that they in fact have not closed, they're still operating. However, we noticed that they took down the sign. They've actually changed the name of the business from Roller Rabbit to The General Store by RR, which is according to what the Roller Rabbit executive told us, and changed some of the offerings inside the store to offer other brands as an attempt to sort of comply with this bylaw. Now, we don't know if the town has sort of reviewed these changes and said you're okay or not, but they have not closed and they're still operating, although, like I said, with those changes.
And what happened? I mean, Ralph Lauren is there. How did they manage to get in?
Well, so they were the impetus.
Predated. So gotcha. Yeah.
So they predate the bylaw, so it does not apply to them. And there are a number of stores that people immediately think of and say, "Oh, well, what about Cumberland Farms or Stop and Shop?" Those are not there's like one Stop and Shop in the downtown district. Again, predates the bylaw. Right. Other stores have grown since they've moved in. People talked about Veronica Beard. When they opened their Nantucket store, I believe it was their ninth store. So they fell under that threshold for the bylaw, but they have since, now have more than 10. So people looking at, it started a whole conversation already this morning about what about this store? What about this store? but again, the mom and pop businesses who we've heard from this morning, this is very important to them. I mean, they talk about how, they want to keep downtown Nantucket special with mom and pop businesses and stores, and that this line of what is a chain and whatnot is become, sort of blurred. And what is a chain? What is it? Does the bylaw apply? Does it not apply? And some of these are very close to that definition, and some have gotten around it. I think we're going to be seeing some more complaints here in the future where the town is going to have to really look and evaluate this bylaw and what falls under it.
I know you'll be keeping an eye on it. Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after break, efforts to save an old Chatham Village landmark and the latest from the State House. You're listening to The Point, and it's the weekly news roundup. Beech leaf disease is killing beautiful old beech trees across the Cape, and the copper beech tree in Chatham Village has stood there for more than 100 years. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to talk about efforts to save this tree. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So the good news is this tree isn't really showing any signs of the beech leaf disease, right?
That's correct. An arborist who was hired by the property owners and analyzed the tree and said that it's healthy at this point. But the property owners are concerned about the future. And beech leaf disease, as you say, Mindy, is sort of spreading around the whole Cape. And so they're proactively treating this tree to hopefully prevent it from getting this parasite that destroys the leaves of the trees and thus weakens the canopy and weakens the whole tree and eventually leads to the trees dying.
There are a couple of ways you can spray. There's a thing they can inject in the tree, but it's expensive.
Yeah, it's about $3,500 per treatment for the injection. Now, with as you said, you can treat it either by spraying or injecting the specific pesticide into the tree that Bartlett Tree Company has developed. And spraying is less expensive, but that only is really effective in areas where there's groves of trees. Injecting works best on individual trees, and so that's what they've done here. The thing is that once you start the treatment, according to Greg Schneeberger, who's with the Bartlett Tree Experts, you have to continue the treatment indefinitely, and it is required every 2 years, basically, to go in and do this injection procedure.
These trees are so beautiful. I mean, we have one right outside the studio here. I mean, they're just gorgeous.
The one we're talking about here, like you said, Mindy, it's over 100 years old. Nobody knows exactly how old it is. It could be as much as 160 years old. It's a huge, massive beech tree. Anybody who's driven down Main Street in Chatham to the lighthouse has seen it. It's on the corner of Water Street and Main Street, just about a block from the lighthouse. And it's, you know, these beautiful branches that are thick. And, you know, the family who owns the property, it's they've owned this property for six generations, and every generation has a story to tell about this tree. So it's really an iconic Chatham tree, and there's a people in town are really grateful that the family stepped up to try to protect it.
Yeah, you have another story this week about fishing, but not in the traditional sense. Fishing with a magnet.
Yeah, apparently magnet fishing is a thing. There's apparently a whole group of people who do it. And this came to our attention. A man from Yarmouth named Nate DeMontigny was magnet fishing in the Herring River in Harwich on the bridge, Route 28 bridge over the river. And he, you know, pulled up what he found after he, you know, took away some of the corrosion on it. Was basically a pistol, a gun, and it appears to be a World War II era Luger. He immediately called the police department because, as he explained, he doesn't have a firearms license, so he couldn't really even touch the gun legally. And the police retrieved it. They sent it to Barnstable County Sheriff's office to investigate whether they could find an ID number on the gun or see if it was related to any open crimes being investigated. Now, Mr. DeMontigny says that this isn't the first gun he's found while magnet fishing. He said he's found about a dozen of them, as well as other explosives and sort of interesting things. Basically, the purpose of these folks who do this magnet fishing is they're trying to clear, metal objects from waterways. They do it throughout the state, and that's a very commendable thing. But they do come up with unusual things like this gun, and who knows what else might be under there.
I pulled up a parking meter from the 1960s in Waltham. I thought that was
pretty. Exactly.
You never know what you're going to find.
Well, people throw all sorts of things in the water, right?
All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
CAI's Gilda Geist checks in with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon, for the latest from Beacon Hill.
Hey there.
The state Senate passed a bill that seeks to limit students' cell phone use in schools. How and why did this bill come about? Is this something that teachers were asking for?
Yeah, this is something really a lot of states are grappling with right now. And lawmakers here say that they've heard from teachers, from parents, from mental health advocates, who are really concerned with the degree to which students are distracted in the classrooms. It's something that has even caught the attention of Governor Healey and State Attorney General Andrea Campbell, who want to see some sort of legislation passed limiting the use of cell phones in schools.
Getting kids off their phones at school, presumably easier said than done. So how exactly is this going to work?
Yeah, some of the specifics here, including how to enforce a cell phone ban, would be left up to individual schools and districts. But the Senate's plan is to have, starting in 2026, the 2026-2027 school year, all public schools in the state would need to have a policy in place that bans kids from holding on to or using their cell phones bell to bell throughout the school day. And it would also be up to the districts to decide where exactly the phones go, if they need to be stored in a special pouch or locker, or how they want to approach it. Parents would still need to have a way, according to these policies, to contact their kids during the school day if necessary.
Moving on to another story from the State House this week, Massachusetts bar advocates are still on strike, seeking higher wages. What impact has this been having on court proceedings in the state?
Well, we've seen, particularly here in the Boston area, but in other places as well, that there are defendants who need to be released, cases dismissed, because people are constitutionally entitled to have legal representation. there are at this point around 3,000 people who aren't represented by legal counsel because of this situation, because of a shortage generally of public defenders and bar advocates willing to take on this work. Now, what we know at this point is that this seems to be continuing and that we'll follow to see what happens.
And Beacon Hill lawmakers say they may have a solution to this problem. So what are they proposing and what do the bar advocates have to say about it?
The bar advocates, at least the group that are no longer taking new cases, there are bar advocates who are still working, including over in Bristol County. But the ones who have been putting up this fight for higher pay want a $35 an hour raise. The package the legislature is moving to the governor's desk today doesn't go quite that far. It proposes a $10 raise this year and a $10 raise next year. So for bar advocates who are holding out for that $35 an hour raise, they say it's not enough. But lawmakers have some other ideas in mind. They also want to fund the hiring of more staff public defenders so that the state doesn't have to rely as much on these private attorneys known as bar advocates. And they want to really write it into state law that similar work stoppages like this would be considered a violation of antitrust laws moving forward. For the bar advocates who aren't currently taking cases, they say this move by the legislature, they see it as vindictive, a retaliation move, and they say it only deepens their resolve. So the bar advocates who gathered here at the State House today to push back on this, they say that the month of August is going to be an interesting one in the courts.
All right. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was CAI's Gilda Geist talking with Katie. A stretch of bike path on the Bourne Rail Trail that just might be too expensive to become reality. Callie Romillard from the Enterprise Newspapers is here with that story. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so this came up at one of the bike path, the most recent bike path meeting that they had in Bourne. So the bike path group in Bourne has really advocated to do rail to trail, which would take up the Falmouth secondary tracks and put the bike path in its place. But for this portion, which is going to start at the railroad bridge near the canal and go down past Monument's Neck and Outlet and Gray Gables, this is only a half mile stretch of trail. And the current price tag is $10.1 million.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is a 130% increase from the price that it was in September, which was about $4.4 million. Really major, major price increase that I don't think really anyone saw coming, including the bike advocates. I mean, they were really taken aback and they called this price tag, you know, indefensible. Some of the members are honestly kind of nervous that this first phase of the bike path will end up being its final phase.
Yeah, well, and the other thing too is like how these prices increase. So, you know, like you think it's going to cost one thing and how quickly that price escalates. And then you have to ask yourself, is it worth it?
Right. And that's really where they're at right now. And part of these increased costs come from a few different things. So because of this being rail with trail, where the bike path would be next to the existing Falmouth Secondary, they're looking to do about $2 million worth of improvements to that segment of the rail, which might cause problems further down the line because they don't want to do rail with trail the entire time. Mm-hmm. Rail with trail is much more expensive than rail to trail. And part of doing rail to trail is ripping up the tracks. But if you put $2 million into improving these tracks, how are you going to convince the state to then rip them up?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's one consideration. And now knowing that this is such a massive amount of money, they're wondering, you know, how long is it going to take us to get phase two, phase three, phase four? I mean, those are way kind of out in the ether right now. And another $2 million cost comes from the soil. They had planned to use the soil that they excavated during, you know, creating this trail and then using that in future phases. But if there's going to be such a long period of time, that soil is going to be contaminated. Now you're looking at an extra $2 million just to bring more soil in to finish the phases.
Wow. All right. So what's the next step? Where do we go from here?
Well, a lot of considerations. To be clear, this is not local money that the town is taking. This is not, you know, coming from the town of Bourne. This is coming from the state. It's coming from federal funds. And some of the bike path people think that this is indefensible and that we really have to consider, like, is this worth it? And others are very much of the opinion that, you know, we've put this much time into it. the state is in control. They're the ones increasing the price. And if we don't take this money, someone else is going to. And another sticking point of the whole issue, which is a little bit separate, is that outlet in Grey Gables. So the Half Mile Trail terminates in a sort of bike, like roundabout. And there's really no other existing infrastructure down there in Grey Gables. So the residents of the village have been really concerned about bikers coming down and sort of just being dumped out into the center of their village. And the bike path's really concerned about the buy-in from the villagers. So they are planning to have a meeting next week, August 6th, where they're going to talk to the residents of Grey Gables and really kind of take their temperature on it. Yeah. And I'm sure there will be a lot of people who are turning up to this meeting in the news of, you know, hey, this is now a $10 million half mile trail. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. All right. Kelly Roma with the Enterprise. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after break, New Bedford Public Schools recover from federal funding chaos. We'll have that and more. You're listening to The Point. It is the news roundup this morning. As we mentioned, union nurses at Cape Cod Healthcare prepared to go on strike if necessary. John Paradise from the Enterprise Newspapers has that story. Hi, John.
Hi, Mindy.
Tell us what's happening with the nurses. What are they looking for?
They are looking for better wages. They're looking for better staffing. And they're also looking to hold down an increase in their own healthcare costs. Back on July 15th, they went on picket in Falmouth and in Hyannis just to sort of spread the word. And then we heard on Monday from the Massachusetts Nurses Association that they had voted, that the nurses at both hospitals had voted to authorize a strike, a possible 3-day strike. But that vote doesn't mean they're automatically going to go on strike. It just means that they've voted to authorize it. So the next negotiation session with Cape Cod Healthcare is Monday, and if they don't feel like they're making any progress, then they can move to go on strike. But one of the things they're going to do is they're going to give the hospital managers a 10-day notice before they go on strike.
I was going to say, yeah. So what happens? I mean, I guess authorized to strike means the hospital has to be prepared to cover these nurses, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it would be disruptive for sure.
And what is the hospital saying about negotiations?
Well, the hospital, again, they're in negotiations, so they're not saying much. They say that they have made some generous offers, but the nurses just don't feel that it's gone far enough.
Are they trying to compare with what's being paid off Cape, or, you know, what are they?
Exactly.
So they want to be paid simply because we're having nurses who are going off Cape to work. Is that what's happening?
Right. So nurses are heading across the bridge. You know, they're going as far as Boston to work. The nurses say they're not looking for, you know, exactly Boston wages, but they're looking for something, you know, comparable.
Right.
You know, because life on Cape Cod is not cheap, as we all know.
All right. John Paradis from the Enterprise and Newspapers. I'm sure you'll keep us posted on this story.
You bet, Mindy. Thank you.
Thank you. Federal funding cuts to education created months of chaos and adjustments in the New Bedford public schools. New Bedford Light's Colin Hogan joins us with news that the money the Trump administration was previously withholding is now going to be released. Is that right, Colin?
Hi, Mindy. Yeah, that's right. On June 30th, the Trump administration decided that it was no longer going to freeze $6 billion of education funding that was going to all 50 states. And more than $100 million of that was going to Massachusetts. And we drilled down and looked at the impact of $2.6 million that was headed to New Bedford Public Schools. That money, if it was withheld, would have caused the closure of after-school and summertime programs. But after Massachusetts and 23 other states sued the Trump administration, it seems that the federal government reversed course and decided that it would allow the money to flow.
Yeah. And so for New Bedford, it's about, 10% of the school funding that comes from the government. One of the programs that would have been really impacted by this was this new kitchen facility, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you're correct to say that 10% of federal funding, 10% of New Bedford funding does come from the federal government. And there were several threats to education funding that were impacting New Bedford. This most recent funds that were restored were going to the after-school and summertime programs. But just months ago, there was other funding that was threatened when the Trump administration decided to claw back $14 million from New Bedford Public Schools over COVID relief money, known as ESSER funds, that were unspent. And those ESSER funds, New Bedford had already used to start a number of projects around the district, One of the biggest ones, you're right, is that central kitchen facility. So when the funds were clawed back earlier this year in March, lots of contracts, lots of capital projects that were underway were thrown into chaos. That was a second lawsuit that Massachusetts joined against the federal government, saying that that withholding of and clawing back of ESSER funds, the COVID relief dollars, was also illegal. And the Trump administration also backed down from that. So the kitchen opened earlier this month, actually on July 1st. And in the whole chaos of funds that are being pulled back and reawarded, it was actually at the opening of that brand new central kitchen, which was previously threatened, that administrators were learning about the $2.6 million that was then withheld from title funding.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different funding sources, and lots of them have been threatened and now restored.
And the, you know, the kitchen is it's a big deal. I mean, feeding kids is a big deal.
Absolutely. New Bedford Public Schools is actually responsible for feeding not just the kids in its own public schools, but its central kitchen provides meals to area religious schools, area charter schools. There are thousands of students every day who depend on New Bedford Public Schools' central administration to cook for their buildings that don't have kitchens of their own. Mm-hmm. Mayor John Mitchell said at the opening of this new kitchen that a project like this ends up helping students perform better. They will learn better because of buildings like these. And Superintendent Andrew O'Leary also told us that these buildings pay for themselves in the long term. It's federal funding, but it provides so much good to the district and does good for students and also for the district's own bottom line.
Yeah, good that this money was restored when you think about all the pressures on the school budgets. And it's a tough time to be running a school, for sure.
Absolutely. And the chaos of having these full funds pulled back and then restored was not the ideal process. And administrators are going into this next school year understanding that funds they thought were previously promised, including all these funds we've been discussing, were congressionally approved and then were pulled back. So it's a new landscape entering the upcoming school year. But as of the moment, the funds that were previously pulled back are now restored, and the projects we've been discussing have been able to move forward, and the kitchen is open and serving meals.
All right. New Bedford Lights, Colin Hogan. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you.
All right. Youth football program on the Vineyard being shut down. Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times has more on that. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mindy.
So tell us about this. What's this program?
This is a junior football program. It's not been shut down yet. It's kind of there's a fear that it could. They're kind of going into their season later this month, and they need about 20-25 kids. And so far they've only had 3 signups.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, it is still early, but if you look nationally and there are stats up and down, but football is one of those sports where some areas parents are reluctant. We got a lot of different thoughts from folks on, yeah, on why this might be happening here.
Is it concerns about, you know, the injuries from that football players can sustain? I mean, I can understand parents would be worried about that.
Yeah, right. CTE has been in the news quite a bit recently. But I think also, you know, one of the coaches we spoke to at the high school who's worried about not getting enough players at the high school eventually is saying, you know, kids are going online more nowadays and they're socializing, you know, over social media rather than back in the day,
yeah,
as you might say. Kids were going outside and having fun.
Yeah.
You got to wonder, too, the Vineyard, maybe it is fewer families on the island. So, you know, a whole bunch of factors. One interesting thing, we found a Washington Post article that did a survey across the country, and I thought very interesting in more conservative areas, they're not seeing declines in football participation, whereas more liberal areas, you do see that, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Right. Another story you have, which is just going crazy on social media, is Alan Dershowitz upset about how he was treated at the farmer's market.
Yes. Alan Dershowitz, famous island resident, you might say. But right, it's, you know, interesting story. He went to the farmer's market, as he told us he's done for decades in West Tisbury, and went to buy some pierogies from a vendor, and the vendor refused to sell to him. We haven't spoken to the vendor, but we've heard from witnesses that were there, and we've talked to Alan, and it was over his political views. You know, he's represented some interesting folks in the past, O.J. Simpson, Jeffrey Epstein. And I think he also represented Trump during the impeachment hearings. And that's kind of, since then, he's been, some have used the word shunned on Martha's Vineyard. So he, after that he was refused, he kind of, some said, caused a bit of a disturbance at the farmer's market. And now he's threatening to sue if the farmer's market doesn't, you know, at least write into their bylaws that the vendors can't refuse to sell to folks based on politics or religion. And I think the interesting rub here, he told me at least that he plans on going back to the farmer's market on Saturday to buy pierogies.
Whoa.
So and I think, you know, it's a story we were kind of like, do we write about this? Is there a story here, or are we just kind of giving a platform for but you know, a lot of folks have stood up for the vendors, saying, you know, they really have the right to do this based on political, you know, we've actually talked to attorneys who said, no, that they didn't do anything wrong. They're allowed to refuse based on political beliefs. And puts the Ag Society in an awkward spot where they're being careful with their words, but they're reviewing this and they're somewhat troubled. But it's certainly it's got
legs. Yeah. All right, Sam Houghton from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
All right, summer season more than half over, and how the tourist season is shaping up in Provincetown depends on who you ask. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent has the particulars. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. So tell us what you're finding.
Yeah, it's numbers moving in a lot of different directions, again, kind of depending on where you are. The ridership on the ferries is down about 10%, which is one of the main ways people come into town here. But then the parking lots are more full than ever. They fill up earlier, they stay full longer, more individual people and staying for longer. So that is a change in what kind of visitors are coming, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as we look through different businesses, the Dolphin Fleet was down about 11%. That's our big whale watching company. The dune tours, which take people out through the Province Land dunes, is down about 15%. But a lot of restaurants and retail are up, you know, by pretty significant numbers. So changing consumer patterns that are kind of hard to disentangle.
Yeah. Do you think some of it is more like people, local people driving into Provincetown versus the typical tourists that you'd been seeing in the past?
Well, some of it, that is a very interesting thing, is that a much larger amount of Provincetown's market is what they call the driving market than is commonly realized. And sure, people fly from Washington, people fly from New York, but if you consider the Northeast Corridor to be driving distance, that turns out to be 85%, maybe even more, of the customers here in a normal year. So it is a very Northeast Corridor tourism market.
Mm-hmm. And this, some of the, you mentioned the retail stores, and this covers like a lot of different types of merchandise. Are we seeing, you know, like the souvenir shops doing better than some of the others? What are we seeing there?
Souvenir shops are good, but also, you know, we have the meals taxes, every restaurant added together, right? And so they're up about 10% in their reports. The hotels tax is up about 9%, but short-term rentals, which is reported separately by the state, they pay the same tax, but they break it out, is down 12%. Yeah. So again, changes in the market where short-term rentals are getting softer, hotels are still strong, restaurants still, you know, 9%, 10%, those are more than just the price increases that you see. That means, you know, higher volumes.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned some of the restaurants doing well, because it seems like you hear a lot of complaints from visitors and people talking about how much restaurant prices seem to go up. I mean, you get it. I mean, food prices have gone up as well. But a lot of people saying, you know, we're just not eating out, or we're, you know, being, you know, eating out less. So interesting that your restaurants seem to be doing pretty well.
One working theory I had is that you had some of the outdoor recreation that was down. So the Dolphin Fleet, the dune tours, while your hotels and restaurants were still up, which is sort of those discretionary things you add onto your trip. Oh, let's do this sunset cruise. Maybe people are cutting back on that, but you know, they do still have to eat. So mm-hmm. people may not like the prices they're paying, but you know, they're still going out to eat.
Right. All right. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
All right. That wraps up this week's Regional News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.